You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together. Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I'm joined today with Mike Gallant. I'll let you introduce yourself a little bit, Mike, and just give a kind of a little background on like how you got into powerlifting, how long you've been lifting, that kind of stuff.
I did my first meet in 1998. I played hockey up until college, and then I just got out of team sports, so I wanted to do an individual sport, and I always liked the lifting. And that's it. I got used to going to Powerlifting USA, Muscle and Fitness, and then I said I'd rather do a powerlifting meet. And I had to go look up, you know, a program in like Powerlifting USA, you know, to get started for a first meet. I had to find a meet in Powerlifting USA. You had to look in the back. And I really wanted to do like without the equipment. That was just looks like it was too overwhelming. Even back then, it looked like it was overwhelming. But I found a meet in Pennsylvania. It was a raw meet. And I had to fly out to it. And I came in dead last. And it was the first time I ever saw kilo plates, which was weird. And then I came back, met up with my old high school coach, who was a football coach. Even though I didn't play football, he was into powerlifting. And I started training with him, and he introduced me to Westside training, like that early on. And we kind of were getting all our information from like articles in Powerlifting USA, from like the DVD tapes, I mean the VHS tapes. And there was a magazine, video magazine called Powerlifter Video Magazine. And you might get clips from that also from Westside. But we just started pounding away on the program, maxing out all the time, like hard. We would take a lift, miss, try it again. Sometimes you'd get it like on the third or fourth try. Most times you just beat yourself up. But that's Al Fanaro. He's the football coach there now, and he was the strength and conditioning and football coach right through. But Dave Tate was doing a seminar, and it was at Art McDermott's in like 1999. And Al found it on like a forum, so we went up to that. Dave Tate was there, and he did a whole day. It was a 2-day seminar, so the first day was all programming. So he filled in like so many blanks of Westside and all the training and all the stuff that was like lagging behind on like the articles you get in Powerlifting USA might be like 2 or 3 months old, or some stuff he wouldn't even like fill in a lot of information. He just talked about some lifters. So you were able to get all the information we needed up to date from Dave Tate then. But the next day, this is where I really started to understand what like training for like Westside training was. The next day was you did speed bench. And this is when Dave Tate was in his prime and he was chasing a 600-pound bench. So he had us set up in groups, and Al at the time was also chasing a 600-pound bench. So they set up the bands and you were doing speed bench. So I was able to see like the grips, how fast, the rest periods, the intensity of everything. And this is when like a shirt might give you like, I don't know, 50 pounds. So these guys were strong. They were throwing around serious weight. So they're going back and forth, Al and Dave, on speed bench, rep for rep, speed for speed. And Dave starts getting mad. And I didn't know why. I thought he was like frustrated that he had a lift at the seminar with all of us there. And they're going back and forth. And he gets up and he goes, all right, next exercise. And he went right into like board press. So it was like a 4-board press with like more bands on it. And they start going at it for 5 reps. So I'm starting to see, like, I understand you have speed work, you work assistance work, you work in muscle groups. But then I'm now starting to understand Dave's intensity, because Dave starts getting pissed because Al is going rep for rep for him again. And all of a sudden it goes from 5 reps to 4 reps to 3 reps and then max it out. And it's a contest. So I saw speed bench. I saw max effort. I saw the intensity of what had to be the lift at Westside. And that was a huge for both of us to understand, like, you know, to get such a big jump on the training. And it was pretty cool at the end, after after they finished benching, they both, I think, missed the last weight. It turned into a contest. And Dave got up and he said to Al, he goes, how much do you fucking bench? And Al goes, like 585. And Dave threw the wrist wrap down. And he goes, you should be benching 600 like me. But that was a really cool experience. But I kind of got easily hooked right into the Westside program right from the beginning.
So from that seminar, what were the like three biggest takeaways that you took? Obviously, the sounds like the training environment piece, the intensity, the competition, all of that stuff. But what were some of the other gaps that were kind of filled in?
The gaps were they didn't get into the max effort the way I wish I could have explained it more. Is much later I learned about max effort, the best way to do it. But I did learn that about the speed. Speed was so important. So if there is a hard max effort day, speed is just critical. It has to be fast. I mean, the bar was flying. Dave Tate was almost coming off the bench. He was pushing the bar so fast. And that's, and then I learned when they really do close grip, they are strong inside. I mean, they bring their hands in. They are just powerful. So the triceps are huge.
And then they probably didn't lose speed regardless of grip.
No, right? They were strong everywhere. Every single grip was strong. And then afterwards, he would go into his assistant's work. So he did the whole workout right in front of me. The rest of the work was really about like bodybuilding, getting a pump, like endless lateral raises, front plate raises, back work. It wasn't like, it just all of a sudden powerlifting kind of stopped and it went into bodybuilding. And that was kind of big because so many times, like you go over to like a bent over row and all of a sudden you turn that into max effort too. But he really was the speed work, assistance work, main mover, and then it was just bodybuilding work.
So he wasn't taking the accessories to failure for the most part. They were kind of just like moderate weights.
Some of them would be like, yeah, like you could see a little bit to failure. Like I was getting a good pump and tired and then that was it. But it was reps. It was definitely reps on the way out. You started with the hard stuff. And as you went through the workout, it's reps on the way out.
So one of the things that I know, like Dave was big on when he was at Westside with the speed work was hitting that speed work and then doing something a little like practicing that speed into something a little more moderate to heavy. I don't think he normally maxed out like that. He just kind of got caught up in the.
Oh yeah. That was definitely not the way we learned it. Cause that was pure max effort. it was frightening. When I saw that, I'm like, I don't know if I want to go to Westside right now. This is insane. This is what they're all like.
You had sent me one video a week or two ago, like an old dynamic effort training day. And like, I've seen some of the old like VHS tape videos and stuff. And, you know, you bring up a really good point because it's one thing to sit there and read an article on Westside's blog or read the Book of Methods, but it's a completely like other experience to actually see them training. Because I do feel that like when I watch them training, I kind of understand what Louis's saying more. Because like in the Book of Methods and on his blog, like Louis's, that's just his thought process, right? And you're actually seeing that thought process play out in the gym. And I do find that stuff helpful. When you do your speed work, do you typically work up to something that's kind of like, do you keep the speed fast and then work up to something that's a little more moderate for the last couple sets? Or you just keep the weights light the whole time?
More on the lighter side and try to use the camera now to tell if it's moving fast. But it kind of all depends on the max effort day. If the harder that max effort day is, the more I definitely respect the speed day. So if a max effort ended up being a really, really difficult day, if I have a percentage, if you say you're working with like 40 to 45 or 50%, I would definitely go on the lower end on the speed day.
Oh, I like that. That's something that I haven't thought about. So like what we'll do with our max effort work is, so we run everything in 3-week waves. So like I don't have Westside lifters, right? They don't need to vary the exercise every week for the most part. So, and they can improve, like it's a new exercise. They kind of figure out the technique. So let's say they week one, they hit a 10. The following week, we'll do like some rep work at like 80% just to kind of get a good feel for it, get some work in, and then we'll come back and max it out. I've never thought of taking on that week if they're doing like 80%, maybe pushing that other day a little bit more. Because like Hartman would have me with the speed work, I'd work up to where I kind of felt that like pop and like you kind of peak with that speed. Because, you know, like each set gets a little bit faster, then you kind of hit that peak and then you start getting tired and the speed slows down. And yeah. Like right before I'd hit that like fatigue part, I'd start loading up some weights. So it might right. be like 4 to 6 sets. And then I might add, I don't know, like 10, 15 pounds, nothing crazy. And then just, you know, work up to something that's like a, around like an RPE 8, 9, like just practicing that speed work with the like moderate to heavier weights. And I really liked that part of it, but I've never rotated it through with the other stuff. And that actually makes a ton of sense.
About a year or two later, we were lucky. We went out to the original super training seminar in Las Vegas with Mel Siv and Louis Simmons.
Oh yeah.
And so this is where like Buddy Morris was there, Joe Ken, JL Holsworth, Mark Bell was there. It was kind of like the first time the two of them had gotten together. And like we were very lucky to get out there, Al and I. And I'm the guy that, you know, I drive around a little pickup truck cutting lawns, and I'm at this seminar, you know, just asking questions with all these amazing, you know, strength coaches. But one thing he said then was Mel Siv is when he said that, you know, you don't train maximally, you don't train minimally, you train optimally. And then Louis goes on later to say that that's one of the most profound things that Mel ever said. And from then they started on max effort days, teaching it more about making a record and going like 9 out of 10, 9.5 out of 10, and leaving something in the tank. And that was like a big change in their training. And he even talks about that now in some of the videos. He said that Kenny Patterson and George Albert, he pulled out a 2.5 pound plate and he said, this is the plan. He goes, you make a 5 pound record, you leave something in the tank and you walk away. And I think that's the biggest change I've made in max effort work over the like 22 years of lifting is you leave something in the tank and walk away. And then you have more on the speed day that you can actually put into speed.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So we do the same thing. I tell them every week, leave 5 or 10 pounds out there so that the following week we can go get it or whatever. But I've never thought of what that does to the rest of the week for training so much. You know, I'm always in that, well, if it's a 9.5, 10, a couple of days later, they're probably fine. But you're right. Like if you're really grinding something out, it takes a lot out of you. Yep. And even like, you know, when you think of it in that like risk reward spectrum, like you're probably not getting a ton more. Now, don't get me wrong. Like I do feel that there are situations where I think it's important for you to really test yourself and see where you're made out of. So
absolutely.
So like once a month, so on the third week of a wave, I tell them hit that 5 pound PR. And if there's more there, put it on the bar, be aggressive with it. Like at this point, it's money in the bank. See what you're made of. So I think competing once a month is important. But at the same time, you're right. There's a huge cost associated with it in terms of recovery. So you definitely couldn't do it all the time. And even like some of the ones who lift a lot more weight, once a month can be a lot. Yeah. Especially because we max out the pulls every other week too. So there's like this fine line of that 5 pounds can make a huge difference in terms of recovery. So before you went to the seminar, you basically would just pick an exercise and just max it out. And did you alternate it each week?
Yeah, they alternated each week. We pick it out, max out, and be kind of just like, we just go until death. And then we eventually just go in and compete in meets and hopefully we made progress. It wasn't as fine tuned as I have it now, where I can almost predict what's going to happen. But we did learn a lot of that coming out of that seminar. We filled in a lot of information. One of the weird things that took me a year or two to finally even understand, Louis goes, he goes, why don't you spell your name right? You're only going to spell it wrong. And I'm like, what? What does that even mean? And it took me a while, but he was basically saying, once you know how to squat, then you're just going to get stronger. Don't waste any more time on technique. You know, and I don't know what you think about that.
I think for the lifters that he has, like if they're coming there and they're lifting that much weight, their technique tends to be fine, right? It's just kind of like learning how to like put everything together. I do think there's a fine line. Like if you focus so from doing all the Shaco type stuff, right? If you focus so heavily on technique with lighter weights, we were just talking about the importance of speed. It slows people down and they start to overthink it. Right. Instead of being an athlete, getting after it and just making adjustments as you go along, like especially with powerlifting, it's not like, you know, you go out to the mound in a baseball game, and you're like, hey, you're overstriding or something. And like they can just make a quick adjustment. And they're back to doing what they were doing before. It's like if there's a technique breakdown, especially in a beginner lifter, it takes a long time to build back up. And if they're constantly just so worried about what it looks like, you never build that like base of strength. So like I kind of go both ways with it. And we'll use on our like speed work days, I'll do more like shake-up type stuff, like using certain variations to work on some technique and try to get some balance, you know. And I think, you know, there are times too where you might tell a lifter that it's like, hey, I don't care if you hit an all-time PR weight-wise, I want to see the technique look better. You know, I want to see a better arch back on a deadlift or whatever it may be. So I think it just kind of, it all depends. I think too often too, like there's always this trade-off, right? Like beginner lifters are scared of big weights and then their technique breaks down anyway. So you can do all the practicing you want with the lighter weights. I've never seen it really carry over to that. And when I'm talking heavy weights, like you see these programs now where it's like, oh, I took a single at an 8, and like, yeah, physiologically there may be some benefits to that, but it's not 95 to 100%. And like, you need to be in those ranges to kind of see what's going to break down. And like, you need to bring that psychological piece into it, the nerves and all of that stuff, to really see what the lifter's capable of. And I think as a coach, if you're just judging everything off 70 to 80%, I don't find a whole ton of value in that. I don't know if you've kind of found similar things over the years.
Yeah. I think the max effort is critical, but like I follow a lot of what Matt Wenning does. And Matt Wenning, I think from a longevity aspect, really has it down right. Cause he worked with Ed Cohen trying to bring like almost like a periodization into the program, into the max effort every once in a while, like a test or a real squat. So he would work that in periodically. And I found that over time for max effort, I rotate between a squat and a deadlift every week. But I also rotate three different intents over those 2 weeks. So I would have a strain day. The next day will be the next week will be an overload day. And the next week will be a test day. And that kind of also self-regulates the like the load on you for the rest of the week. On the strain days, I'll usually end up using a weight that's much lighter than I do on competition, but the time it takes to lift that for one rep is longer than competition.
So like a deficit or something?
Yeah, it's a deficit, or if you can design the exercise right with chains and bands so that it will take longer. And the weight won't wreck you because it's less than you're going to lift in competition. And the next week will be an overload, and now it'll flip. It'll be a squat, and the first week might have been a deadlift. The overload will be greater than you're going to handle in a meet. So the confidence is right there. Your central nervous system is ready for whatever you're going to do with the meet. And then the next week will be a test. And you'll test that. I mean, it'll be once every 6 weeks for each one. But when you test, at least you know what's working and what's not working. If you have a reliable tester, whatever that may be for the lifter.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you're not using like a comp lift as a tester. You've kind of figured out what your testers are over time and you throw one of those in.
Yeah, but everyone's different. I mean, I know the trap bar is almost a given for me, what that is, you know, what it equals to, what a close grip could be, how that transfers over. But yeah, and someone may have to do just a competition lift and just see where they are, or just move a weight, just a test. But that kind of almost regulates it a little bit more compared to the way we used to do it at the very beginning, when we just went till death.
And when you were just going to death, you just kind of did whatever, like there wasn't, you didn't have like a, like you were saying, like a periodized structure of the load for each max effort lift.
Nope. And that's one of the questions I've actually even reached out to like a bunch of people from that have trained at Westside, and I've asked them, like even Shauna Mendelson. And she said, no, that, you know, it's not always just sit at breakfast and just decide. And I think even on Anthony Olivier's podcast, he said, he goes, he had something planned and Louis said, no, you're going to do this today. So there seems to be some type of a structure. Maybe that's, unless you're at Westside, you don't know what's actually happening there, but it is tough to say just at breakfast, the biggest guy calls the shot. I don't know if that's true or not, but I can't just go in at my age at 46 haphazardly and just do whatever. There has to be thought to it.
Yeah. I would imagine there's times where they start talking shit and then that stuff happens. But I've always had in the back of my head that like, there's probably a lot more planning to it than what they talk about. And I try to do a similar thing with the max effort work by adjusting loads. And sometimes I periodize it in the same way, like something that like would have lower absolute loads to medium absolute loads to high absolute loads. How did you, so when you use your variations, do you kind of, so I know some of the guys at Westside kind of use the same four or five variations that they just continuously cycle through. Do you do the similar thing, or do you use a lot more variation?
It was probably about, I'd say about at least 12 that you'll go through.
Okay. And so when you do your speed work, do you always have deadlifts in there with the lower body speed work?
Sometimes I will. Not all the time. Sometimes I do more bent over rowing.
Okay. Because like I've known a lot of so I know like Vincenello said he wished he had deadlifted less in training. Ernie Hackett had said the same thing. Milanochev was deadlifting once a month. Yeah. It just seems like one of those lifts you just don't need in there as frequently once you become a little bit stronger, it seems like.
I think you're right. It kind of depends on your body structure too. If you're if the deadlift's easy for you, you might want to spend more time doing the assistance work than doing the actual, you know, pounding away the deadlift, make something harder.
How often do you use Good Mornings?
Good Mornings every week. I took them out of the max effort day. I know Westside does them on max effort day. I just stick with a squat or a deadlift, and on speed squat day, it's speed squats, some deadlift, you know, work, and then it's Good Mornings every week.
How heavy do you take the Good Mornings?
Yeah, that is all depending on how heavy the max effort was. So the max effort sets the tempo for the whole week.
I've actually been, so I throw the Good Mornings are in when we do our max effort squat on the first day of the week. So if they do, if they're maxing out on a squat and they hit a 5 pound PR, those Good Mornings just become like light to moderate. If they're doing work on the squat, we get the intensity from the Good Morning. So like I'll throw like RP 9-10 in there for the Good Morning. So the intensity does kind of fluctuate that way. So you feel pretty good throwing it. How many sets and reps are you doing of the squats and deadlifts on speed day?
It seems that from everything I've been reading and all of everything I kept up on over the years, it seems to be about 25 working reps is what they stay with. Simmons even mentioned that he got that from Shaco, that they do about 25 working reps on the deadlift on the speed day. But unless you're at Westside, you don't know what they're doing. But I'm just going off of what I, you know, from the podcast. So, but I noticed that he has over the years gone from a 12x2 to do 5x5, 6x4, 4x6. You know, 12x2, they almost like taper down from time under tension with the 5x5s and work their way down as a meet comes to like a 12x2 to make it like more sport specific.
Yeah, more speed work, more first reps.
Yeah.
The one thing that, so we'll do like 5x5s and stuff like that, pretty light. So the one like issue that I have personally with like doing sets of five is like creating tension for a set of five. You know, you're talking 25, 30 seconds is fucking hard. And if you have lifters that have a difficult time creating tension, it's like the first couple will look good. And then after that, they just kind of look like shit. So we kind of do it in a reverse way. Like we'll do doubles before we do threes, fours, fives. Have you found any benefit to tapering it from fives to twos?
I think over the weeks, you notice a difference. Yeah. Definitely. You know, you could do 3 week waves of like a 5x5, 4x6, 6x4, and then come back up to like a, you know, a 6x4, you know, 8x3, 12x2, kind of like little waves like that.
Always around those 25 reps.
Always. That's what they seem to be from all the reading. And there's a handful of guys that I've talked to that have been there and they said, that, yeah, it really is. They're doing 5x5s now. And I try to listen to Anthony Olivieri, everything he puts out, and try to pick through everything. And I think that's what you'll see them doing.
I have seen some five, and I actually think he told me that too, that they've done some 5x5 stuff over the years. So you'll do 25 squat reps, 25 deadlift reps, and then the good mornings.
And then good mornings, yeah. And good mornings will be how you are recovered from your max effort.
Okay.
And then it's just your book, just like you saw Dave Tate do, just all into bodybuilding work for all the muscle groups right through. And whatever you have that day, whatever you can do, you just go.
What are your typical break periods during the speed work?
Oh, try to keep with the 60 seconds.
But really quick.
Yeah. But that take, you know, it's been a long time. doing it. When we first started, we were doing like 45, 60 seconds. So it's, you know, 22 years of it. You're used to it.
Right.
You just, it's in shape. Like just yesterday we were training max effort. And I looked at my, I think I went from the last five attempts I did. I was 3.5 minutes on each max effort in between each attempt.
Yeah. That's it's a quick turnaround.
Yeah. You just kind of, yeah. I think you just kind of get used to it.
What, how long does a typical training session take for you to complete?
The max effort usually seems like the one movement between your warming up takes about an hour. Then you, depends, like I'm at MetFit and I'm like my, the owner is a Multiply guy, Robert Propp, and he's got a big meet. So we spend like about another 2 hours doing our assistance, but helping him in between.
But the actual training itself is about an hour.
I say about 3 hours. We're probably there.
Holy shit.
But there's a lot of you know, helping other lifters. So it's not like you're just going straight anymore. It seems like,
I get what you're saying.
You know, yeah. So if I was by myself, I'd say you're out of there in an hour and a half, 2 hours at the most.
Yeah. That's kind of how we are, like an hour, hour and a half. One of the things when I was doing like, and even now, so like we had less weights. So I was doing some type of press every day. I was squatting. Like, I just don't have the like mental energy to go longer than 45 minutes to an hour type of thing. Like I get to a certain point and I'm just like cruising through bench because I'm kind of mentally checked out at that point. And like one of the things I like about doing a more like conjugate based style of training is you get more quality reps. And I think part of it is just that mental focus you're able to put into each repetition. Have you found like similar stuff?
The intensity definitely after that main movement, it's hard to stay that intense, especially if you go in groups like helping other people in the gym. I can understand how the bodybuilding just rep work, because you don't have to put as much mental energy. You just go for a pump or a burn, and the hamstrings just beat them up, or the lower back or whatever the muscle group is.
That's a good point. I've never thought of that that reason for the accessory work, and that makes a ton of sense. So you started competing in 98.
Yep.
How many raw meets were there a year? Like how many times were you able to actually get to a competition?
We were competing like every 3 to 4 months. We'd find something, but like the very first meet I did, I didn't know anything about powerlifting. So I just found a raw meet. It said raw. So that's why I went to Pennsylvania. But then I learned, you know, you can just go in and everyone's lifting with equipment. You're just probably going to come in dead last. The USAPL was just kind of, you might have had them, you know, throwing a meet around. At the time, they were like not a very well organized meet, but I think they did have some raw divisions. And it was hard to find a full raw meet. The AAU at the time had the AAU Raw Nationals, and they were like that was the only organization that had like a raw, like you could build up to something. If you want to put in perspective about like competition and how strong people were, the first meet I went to, I was in the 198 class. The guy who won squatted 600, benched 425, and deadlifted 600. I mean, that was the best in the country, raw. So like now you see guys that are probably like 165 doing that.
Do you think that's just more people getting involved in the sport?
I think it's two things. I think there's more people getting involved. I think there's a learning curve, but it's also like a belief curve with these phones that you can see people lifting so much more so fast, because you didn't see anyone lifting. You kind of thought like a triple bodyweight squat, double bodyweight bench, a triple bodyweight deadlift. That was huge. But you didn't see anyone that now you can see real time on the phone, someone posting something, and immediately you go back to the gym with a belief like, wow, there's so much more that you can do. Look at this kid right here. And then someone else will beat that on the internet and you'll see someone lifting that. So I think people believe more that they can lift more. Before, we had to look at powerlifting USA. You had to wait like 4 months for the results. And someone might make a 10-pound record and be like, wow. And you take 6 months before you see something else.
It's like when the first 4-minute mile was completed. Yeah,
absolutely.
Like it took forever for that to happen. And then it just happened a bunch absolutely. Of times. Yeah, you're right. And I remember on I don't know what it was. And if it was a podcast or if it was a video, but like Louis talking about like the records on the board. And he's like, these names are here because of the names that came before them. Like
right.
Once you see a weight on the board, you're like, oh, well, that person's made of the same shit that I'm made out of. So I'm going to go after that record. And then somebody puts that there and then somebody puts the next one. And that's how you get 30, 40 years of continual progress.
Oh yeah. We did a meet. It was a meet, like I think it was like 2001. And there was a bench press specialist at the time. His name was Glenn Shabbat. And he could bench in a shirt like 720, but in it without a shirt, he could bench 660. So he wanted to break Bill Kazmaier's record. So they had a bench division for him during the meet. He came in and he did his attempts and he just missed 660 at the top. But that was like the biggest bench of like an entire year. Nothing else was happening. Now that, you know, Julius Maddox and, you know, is going after this record and people coming back trying to get this record, everything's moving so fast. It's definitely has to do with the social media and you see things.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. Like I remember reading something too. Like, so horses don't have the same perception that humans have, and the fastest time was still Secretariat, which happened in like the 70s or something. So like the fact that like horses can't perceive somebody else's abilities the same way, and like that record just had stuck around forever, but like, you just don't see that in any sport. It's not even just powerlifting. It's, you know, people's ability to just kind of one up somebody else. And you kind of wonder where it will all stop. Like at the Arnold this year, there was how old, I want to say there was like a 19-year-old kid who squatted like 900 pounds. Like,
yeah,
that's insane to me.
Yeah.
Something like that. That's a kid.
I way back in like early 2000, I was, I think I just squatted like 550 for the first time and I was really excited. Like 600 pounds was a big deal. So then I'm like, I'm slowly moving my way. And there wasn't anyone like around that was kind of beating me at the competitions. And all of a sudden this kid, you might know him. His name is Greg Panora. I saw him at a meet and he came within like 10 pounds of my squat and was like in like his first meet. And I was like, what am I going to do? This kid's going to just blow right past me. But now you would have seen that on no time on the phone. There'd be no time to like relax. You'd be back at the gym, you know, the next day trying to beat him.
What meet was that at?
That was like, it was an AAU meet. And I think it was like, they had like a regional and then they had like a world meet. And I think it was in like, I think it was in Massachusetts somewhere. I remember he was a local at the time. I've talked with him since after that. And we were in the same kind of circuit of meets. We just never competed against each other. And then he went off the, you know, tremendous success there.
What, I want to hear about some of the differences of the sport back then and what it is like today. Cause like, there's some things that I can even, you know, like when I first get into it, it seemed like there were more groups training together, like doing the same training. And now you have a lot of online coaching. So it's a lot of, you know, you could have the same five people in a gym, but they're doing five different programs and five different racks. And I do think that's a little bit different, but I'd like to hear kind of your perspective on how the sport's changed.
Oh, it's, coming in Westside was really respected and it worked. And like, I only wear a belt. I've never worn knee wraps or knee sleeves. So we just knew it worked and it wasn't a big, you know, difference between it's only for equipped lifting. It was like, no, everyone's getting stronger on it. I actually went out and did there was a big meet when Raw was being pushed. It was the New England Record Breakers. And I went out and I did that. And Ed Cohen was a head judge and it was I think it was around here. I forget which state it was in. And I ended up, this is a funny story. I ended up on my third attempt. I was going to bomb out. Ed Cohen told me to turn my feet out. I turned my feet out and I went down. I never came up with the weight. I almost died, but I talked with Ed later. He explained the whole thing to me, what he was trying to have me do. But after that,
what was he trying to have you do?
I was having a tough time breaking parallel. The weight was going up and down. He goes, you know, you're way stronger than enough for this weight, but you just got to turn your feet out a touch to break parallel. And I never had a problem before, but there was a strict, it was like a money meet. And I was chasing after some guy, you know, try to get first place. You want to get money. And so I just kept going up in weight. And he said, turn your feet out. And I went down. I'm like, I couldn't get up. But it was pretty funny. Yeah. After, nothing got hurt. Thank God. I just bombed out. But I remember like after that, I had to start working two jobs. So I took a few years off and I came back and I did a USAPL meet, and I couldn't understand what was going on. First, there was tons of girls there, which was awesome, because like the sport has exploded. They had, I think, a whole day for women, and everyone was wearing heels. That's what I didn't get. I was like, well, everyone had heels on, and then they had the knee sleeves in the same like singlet, and I thought it was a uniform. I'm like, am I supposed to be wearing these heels? Because I had the Chuck Taylors on. I'm like, I went right back to like what I wore before, but everyone was wearing it. And that was the biggest change. I'm like, something happened. And I went and I talked to some of the guys I lifted with that were involved. And they said, no one falls West Side anymore. It's kind of, it doesn't work. We're not using it. And I'm like, that was the biggest first change. I'm like, wow, there's just a big backlash.
What year was this?
Oh, this is probably, I think it was like around 2010, 2011-ish. Must have been. And I think you wrote a paper, or you were talking about a paper that was talking about how there was a change in training philosophies, and it got published, and you noticed a big change. And
right around that time.
Yeah, right around that time. It was around that time. The sport like looked different. It was just different.
Why do you think the heels came in? Because like
I don't know.
Around forever, right?
That I was most confused about, because I was always taught never go on your knees. You know, protect your knees, always go back. But it's just different. Just must be the way, you know, the training programs are and the coaches. And there's a lot of guys that are really, really strong with heels on. I mean, ungodly strong.
I think part of it, right, it kind of plays to American culture. Like, we play other sports, and most of our sports are very, like, quad dominant. So you kind of want to throw the weight into your a lot of the stronger guys and girls are going to want to throw the weight into the quads, because they've built them up playing, like, you know, me playing soccer, doing the MMA stuff, that's all quads. Yeah. So like my hips and my hamstrings probably not quite as strong. So I, you know, at the time I probably could have lifted more doing it that way. And that's probably why I had such an easier time with the heels. So I always, like when I first started coaching, because everybody was wearing heels and it just, you know, you can stay a little more vertical, you can hit depth. Like I had all these reasons and why it's appropriate. But then like you start looking at like the angles that they're squatting at, and they're sacrificing stability for kind of a tool to help them mask some issues that they may have technique wise in the squat. And then finally I was just like, I don't think the heels make a ton of sense, especially like an aggressive one. So I make everybody train in flats and closer to a meet. If they want to throw the heels on and see how it goes, that's fine. Especially like, you know, everybody needs bigger hips and hamstrings, and nobody kind of focuses on it. Everybody like to initiate the squat. And this is literally why I'm balding, is like, no matter how much I tell somebody to open up your knees and push your hips back to start, everybody sits straight down. So if we're wearing the heels, it allows you to hit depth because of the way you're sitting straight down, instead of teaching you how to really sit back into the squat, load your hips, load your hamstrings, so like not falling forward when the weights get heavier on the way up. I wonder, you know, I mean, my guess is like the weightlifting stuff and CrossFit just kind of bled over into powerlifting when you get this new wave of lifter in the sport.
Well, yeah, I can see that. Equipment. Yeah.
Like in the knee sleeves too. So, I mean, obviously I was wearing them before. And then when I got into the equipment, both like Hartman and Oliveira were like, just don't ever wear those things. And so I was like, that's fine. And you get nothing out of them outside of maybe staying warm if it's cold or something.
Yeah.
But literally I don't feel like I get 1 pound out of them. And mine were pretty tight. It's not a knee wrap. It's not a loose knee wrap. It's like, you don't get much from them. So I wonder if it's just the commercialism of the sport, right? It grew. So you had these companies like SPD and everything else coming out and making some money.
Yeah. They didn't have much for equipment. It was like Inzer had equipment, you know, bench shirt and stuff like that. But you didn't have much for, if you were lifting raw, they didn't even allow they had no knee sleeves. They didn't allow knee wraps for raw. And most of the meets, you kind of couldn't even wear wrist wraps. So you just had a belt. And so there wasn't much equipment even out there to sell.
I want to say this was actually Louis talking about that. Like older meets, you couldn't wear even a belt. Like you literally just went up there and lifted. Like, wrist wraps weren't allowed, belts, knee sleeves, knee wraps, none of that.
Yeah. The money now, if you're going to spend money, you've seen this end up spending in your fallen congee, you spend a lot of money on bands, chains, equipment, specialty bars. That's almost the way that I think the West Side system works its best. But unfortunately, it sometimes costs money. You know, you have one end of the spectrum. You could have just a bench, barbell, a squat rack in your basement, and you could follow West Side. You're limited for what you can do, but there's probably some Russian kid that can still become a world champion with just that. And you have the other end of the spectrum where you're at West Side with all the equipment, all the bands, all the chains, with Louis, you know, and Hoff and Anthony Oliveira. Everyone's there, and then you have all the, you know, every single piece of equipment he's ever invented. And the closer you can get to that, the more potential there is to have success with the program. But that costs money. But now there's so many gyms like that have a lot of equipment, you can get by with that.
It's interesting that you brought up like the Russian piece, because I think part of like why their system was developed the way it was for powerlifting and weightlifting was because the country was broke.
Yeah.
So, like, I did a voiceover for it was a Kirill KK Milanochev video, and they were talking about their gyms that they train at, and these places were just like dungeons with very little stuff. Like, one of the examples they used, like, the leg press was held up by kettlebells, and they were like, it's only for the most desperate lifters. So, like, they had to find a way to get strong with very limited stuff, right? And in those situations, it makes sense to me to do more, like, higher frequency stuff with the lighter weights because, I mean, so even now, right, like, a lot of people are being thrown into their basements in very, very similar situations. So they can't max out because they don't have safety pins, they don't have spots.
Yeah.
They have less weights. So, like, even if they could max out, they can only get up to 70% or something like that. So for me, like, the higher frequency stuff to program for them now just made a lot of sense. But, like, it just, like, reinforces why we don't do it. Like, people are like, oh, my hips kind of hurt, my elbows. Like, it doesn't even matter how light the weight is at times. And, like, don't get me wrong, like, I'm biased and I've probably enhanced their bias and their not wanting to do it somewhat. Plus, you get the stress of a pandemic and all of, you know, of what it comes to with daily life, which could decrease the ability to recover and all of those things. Like, don't get me wrong, I understand there's circumstances to it, but, like, even me, I'm driving my car to pick up my daughter on Saturday and I'm like, my arm is fucking killing me, and, like, I'm not even doing that much. I think it's just like it beats you up over time, and, like, you just get used to it. Like, my elbows used to hurt so fucking bad when I was working with Shaco, and, like, I'd get this, like, little nagging hip things at time. My pec would act up at times. Like, there was always, it didn't stop me from training because the weights were light enough that you could kind of get through it and you'd come out the other side and everything would be fine. But that's definitely, like, an overtraining thing. Yeah. I think what people miss with them too is, you know, who he was coaching, these guys, it's a communist country. They're state-sponsored lifters. That's all that they do. They eat, sleep, and lift. And, like, when you have a job and you have other stuff going on, like, you have a physical job. But yet 22 years later, you're still, you know, you're able to max out every week and still lift. We just haven't seen the long-term success of a higher volume, higher frequency program out there. And maybe you could kind of touch on, because I know you did the higher frequency stuff with me at one point, and, like, just kind of touch upon, like, the differences between the two and the recovery and kind of why you choose to do it the way you do now for the longevity aspect of it.
Yeah. I when I was planning to go to Raw Nationals with you, even just trying to work in a lot more deadlifting, I pulled a muscle in my glute that wrapped around my sciatica. My body just said, that's just too much deadlifting. It's just too much. And that's only like 3 or 4 years ago. And I was just 40 probably. And my body was saying, this is too much. I do think there's Wenning talks about this a lot. He talks about mileage. You know, the more variations there are, the less mileage on the same path, you know, and your body can recover. Yeah, I have found that by accident, this program, you know, the Conjugate West Side, it allows longevity. Maybe that wasn't the intent, because everyone seems to be getting injured and, you know, broken at West Side sometimes, but and Louis broken, but stepping back, probably not being in that environment where you have to be that intense like Dave was at that seminar, the way you can set it up is definitely you get a long longevity out of it. And I'm right now, I know open powerlifting, you know, the records aren't that, you know, accurate with everything, but there's guys I'm chasing that are above me in my weight, in my age group, and I kind of look what they're doing, and they're all doing some form of like a conjugate. So, it, you know, it kind of makes sense, like that's the only way they're still surviving. Like I follow Anthony Harris.
Oh yeah, I love Tony Harris.
Phenomenal legend. And if you watch his training, he does a lot of little variations, and there's a lot of things that change and go outside of that, you know, bar path. And I think that's adds to a lot of longevity.
Do you think part of those records on open powerlifting are just because Westside was the main thing? These guys have just found a way to survive longer in the sport than anything else. And like, you know, years in, a lot of times, like look at somebody like Jennifer Thompson. Like I know she just lost, but it took a long time for a freak to come along and actually beat her 20 plus years of lifting experience. Yeah. So sometimes I just wonder if it's just those guys who've been doing it that way have just, they've been smart. They've stayed above water, stayed as injury free as possible, and were able to put up huge numbers.
Are you saying like following a high frequency or following like a conjugate style?
They were all following a conjugate style because the high frequency stuff just wasn't around then, right?
Yeah. Yep. I never saw anything like when I first started out like a high frequency. It was just that linear, you know, Ed Cohen style, start at the 12 reps, eight, you know, go work your way down to a single. We didn't even know what that was. I was very confused when I came back and saw those programs.
Another thing that like I kind of realized too is a lot of people who've been around a long time in the sport, they lifted in some type of equipment. Like it's always been kind of a part of their training. And a lot of them speak highly of how it's allowed them to kind of train longer and stuff. And I found that interesting. And that was kind of not the reason why I wanted to get into it. I kind of wanted to learn more about it, get more, understand the roots of the sport a little bit more. But a nice little byproduct, it seems like, you know, like, so for example, if I pull sumo for anything more than like 2 or 3 weeks where I'm kind of driving that intensity, I get this weird adductor strain type thing that I have to let cool down for a week or two. But if I do a mixture of sumo raw and then I throw the equipment on, I don't have that same issue and I can continue to train and I never experience the same pain and I'm overloading it. Yeah. So I did find that aspect to be pretty interesting.
I 100% agree with you about equipment. Even though I've never worn equipment, I have seen that definitely it will add to longevity as long as you're not training like you want to hurt yourself. If you're training smart, I think absolutely is the way to go. Actually, years ago, I messaged Anthony Harris because I'm looking for people to follow that are long in the game and successful. And one of the first things he told me was like, put a pair of briefs on your squatting. When you box one, it'll save your hips over time.
I think one of the other things too that people, so I'm trying to get like some of my lifters, they don't have to compete equipped, but even if you just get a pair of briefs, if you don't know how to like create tension on the way down in a squat, like you have to push into the equipment. You have to sit back into it. Like you just get that like tactile feedback from the briefs themselves on how to actually squat. Like I think there's a lot of technique carryover that can come from it too. Not even just saving the hips. Like they're a Titan Superior, which is like the lowest level suit that I think they make is like $80. People spend more on their knee sleeves than they do on something that probably will have greater carryover to the technique and overall health of their squat. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was gonna say that just even the slingshots now. Even if you can't get into a bench shirt, I think a slingshot can save your shoulders tremendously.
Oh yeah, one of the things that Shaco would do with me a lot is because I was benching 4 days a week, is there'd be a lot of board work and a lot of slingshot, and like that's why he said, you know, it was literally, I mean, that first shirt made by John Inzer was because his shoulder kept dislocating. Yeah. Like it was made to protect you. So like a slingshot, yeah, absolutely, does take a lot of stress off the. Off the shoulders.
I remember when you said Shaco came here, you met him that's when you first met him at a seminar.
Yep.
And I think he was up in Malden. And I, if I remember correctly, one of the things Shaco was doing when he went to, I think he went to TPS and he went to Westside, he was taking measurements of equipment because I guess he didn't have any of this equipment available to him. Is that correct?
Yeah, he, so that was actually the second time that he came here. When he went to Westside, yeah, he took like pictures and measurements of all the equipment, like the reverse hyper and stuff like that, yeah, to try to make the same stuff for his gym because they just didn't have that stuff. So like if you looked at my program when I was working with him, there were just a lot of good mornings, a lot of back extensions, a lot of seated good mornings, done with like moderate weights. Like that was the accessory work. And I think a lot of it was just because they didn't have much equipment to actually, like they don't have like we have commercial gyms here. We could sit on some machines and like, I know people badmouth machines, but if you're training the big lifts hard, sometimes it's just nice to be able to get a little like pump in your pecs or something without banging up your shoulders and elbows a little bit more. They just didn't have those same options.
I think that's absolutely it. Even though I haven't used a lot of equipment over the years, I haven't used any, but I've used tons of variation machines. And I think that also can add into longevity.
Yeah, absolutely. Training different angles.
Because we started way back. We had a reverse hyper at Severian back in 2000. So pretty much from day one, and we had the calf-ham glute. We had so much, we're trying to get all the specialty equipment that Westside had. I mean, Al would buy anything, and it added. Over time, you're using those machines, they definitely take wear and tear off of the same, like, same paths.
I would kill to have a place like that to just go and train where like, you know, you've kind of built it up over the years or whatever. Let me ask you this. So because everybody's kind of being thrown into their basement and stuff, if you want to run a conjugate type of program, what would you consider the essentials to have in the basement to do the best you can in a limited amount of space?
I outfitted my basement with what I thought was the essentials.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm asking.
I can only with life get to MetFit 2 days a week. So I do the max effort with them because you need competent spotters, but they have every piece of equipment I need to do max effort there for conjugate style. In the basement, I have a belt squat. I wasn't able to afford Matt Winning, so I got a Titan one. I have a reverse hyper. It's the Scout model, which is like the lightest one, but it works, I think, fantastic. So those two. I have a power rack. I have a variety of bars. I have them on my Instagram. I got a glute ham developer, which is just like a calf ham glute, but without the knee pad, so it's even more difficult. I have a regular hyper extension and a pulley setup. And I have a homemade belt squat that they used to use that style back at Westside, where it's just off of like milk crates, and you use a belt with the weights hanging.
Yeah.
So it's just free. Those are and then dumbbells and stability ball. But that's what I'm gonna have my son do. So he's gonna train in the basement, and I'm surviving for years now, training in the basement during the week, and then training at MetFit on the weekends.
So if you had to choose two or three bars to have in your collection, because like I mean, Westside has, I mean, when I went in there, the amount of bars that they have is insane. But if you had to pick two or three, which ones would you pick?
I think the Duffalo bar is probably the most versatile. You can use it for squats, benching, rowing, anything, and it saves your shoulders. I've used it for front squats now. I even have given up. I don't even back squat on speed squat day. I almost do all my squats front squat or a Zercher squat to save my shoulders. And I found that over time, the stronger I get on the front squat or the Zercher squat, my back squat goes through the roof.
So what do you think that is, like building that upper back? Or?
I think it's building up a back, building the core, and you cannot move an inch. So over time, you have leverage. You just like a piston. It's just a hip hinge. You just slam your hips forward. And when
I saw you doing the front squat box squat speed work the other day, and I was like, oh shit, that looks brutal.
It is brutal at first, but over time it transfers over great for me, but everyone's different. And then you use the good morning really on that day to build your back, and then the max effort days when you have things actually on your back. But the Duffalo bar's excellent. A really good safety squat bar. And you need a good power bar. I like the football bar. I think the football bar saves your shoulders tremendously by being able to turn it.
I never got as much success out of the football bar from using it, but I think it's definitely versatile, and I think I liked it for floor press more than I actually liked it for bench work.
Yep.
And it definitely, like, I mean, it saved my elbows and my shoulders big time, so it still allowed me to train pretty hard in different angles. I kind of want to rewind a second, and like when you were talking about the guys at Westside being banged up, I think one thing that people forget is like those are world-class lifters. So they're making sacrifices to their bodies and pushing things a lot harder than the majority of most power lifters are willing or are capable of doing. So when people use, they're all banged up at Westside as a reason to not follow that type of template, it makes absolutely zero sense to me, because the majority of the people saying that, you're not even close to being as competitive or willing to do the things that they're willing to do to be at that level. And I've had this conversation with other coaches, like when there's a chance for you to do stuff, a lot of high level athletes will sacrifice longevity to break a world record or to get on a certain team or to get a contract, like whether it's taking drugs, whether it's training a little harder, pushing yourself a little harder, you know, at the end of the tunnel that you're probably going to come out of it a little dinged up, but you're making those long-term sacrifices for short-term success. And that's what those guys are doing there. They're lifters that are looking for all-time world records and to really push things and to kind of almost leave an athletic legacy within a sport, where the USAPL has like 20,000 lifters. Out of those 20,000, there's like, I don't know, 50 of them who are like really competitive. So the majority of that population, you're not even willing to do what they're willing to do. So don't disregard the information that they're talking about, how the intensity that they're training at, the environment that they're training in, like all of that stuff plays a role.
I mean, one thing, actually, I'll try to photocopy them after the quarantine's over. I have about 100 something articles from Powerlifting USA that Al and I used to collect. We used to save everything. But a lot of the articles from the beginning were in the early 2000s when the equipment didn't give the guys a lot of like boost. So all the training at Westside was doing way back then was basically to become strong just raw in a belt. And a lot of the exercises are what I do now, but a lot of exercises doesn't seem to be popular now because the equipment does so much work and they have other aspects of training they have to build up. But the training like from the early 2000s, that's almost like a different style of training than now, and is so valuable for raw lifters. I mean, I think anyone can take advantage of them. It's too bad that people look at it, the documentary to just see equipment, and they're like, I'm not going to waste my time. That's for equipped lifters. I actually had a kid come up to me about a couple weeks back and said, you follow Westside. He goes, but you don't wear equipment. I said, yeah, you don't have to. You don't need to. You can do it. It's just getting stronger.
I mean, the crazy thing to think of, right, is like if Dave Hoff squat over 1,200 pounds in equipment, do you not think he can squat a lot raw?
I know. Yep.
Like it doesn't make sense. Like these guys are just strong, like yep. strong, right?
That clip that I sent you, Lou even says in it, it says, Kenny Patterson benched 625 raw, George Halbert benched 640 raw or something like that. I mean, and the shirts only gave him like 40, 50 pounds back then. So they knew how to get strong and stay healthy raw.
Where do you think the negativity towards Westside came from?
I don't know, because I remember after taking a couple of years off, I was almost like yelled at for following Westside by some of the guys that were still lifting. But I honestly don't know if there's some type of like equipment's bad. We have to sell different type of equipment from like companies, you know, we have to use this. Now we're doing knee sleeves and we're just doing belts and heels. I don't know if that, but I really don't know. I think a lot of people could definitely benefit from some of the methods.
I clearly couldn't agree more. I think, you know, I have this like weird, like if you go to like an RPS meet or something, you tend to see a lot of people that follow like a Westside template and they're, they're tatted up, they're listening to metal music, they're a little bit more aggressive personality wise. I don't know if, like, because CrossFit opened up powerlifting to like more of a general pop, it wasn't such a niche sport anymore, even though it's still a niche sport. But you go to a USAPL meet, you see zero tattoos, it's like a bunch of nerds and matching singlets, and it's just, it's like a completely, almost like a completely different culture. Like Westside was from the culture of the sport when it first started, like much more aggressive, the tattoos, the pasts that they had before they got into lifting, like those types of things. Where now it's like anybody who's got access to a gym can start just doing it. And I think it opened it up to the general population, and it just wasn't as attractive to them because they're just a different culture. There's nothing wrong with it. Like some of those nerds can lift a lot of fucking weight.
They're ungodly strong, the kids now. I mean, if put my numbers when I was that age, I'm like, I would have just quit. I mean, the kids are so strong now. It has taken a long time to get, you know, this strong, but I don't know where it came from. I mean, I wish Louis would have, you know, put more people out there into that raw arena instead of just saying, well, we did that, you know, we don't have to do it again. Because he's probably get all the money he needs. He doesn't need it anymore, but he really could put some guys out there that can clean house.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it'd be interesting if like Dave Hoff was just like, you know what, I'm sick of people talking shit, I'm gonna do a raw meet, and then he just like crush some lifts.
Yeah, because the program will definitely make you strong, and there are some godly strong guys there.
Oh yeah, and like the other, like,
and girls,
Yeah, I mean, their girls might even be
stronger. I mean, it's strong. I think the girls are stronger than the body weight wise, and you know, Wilkes thing. Then.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think like nobody should be shitting on another program type of thing either. It's sad because like powerlifting is like a sport without role models. It's like a bunch of 25-year-olds with very limited experience screaming from the mountaintops that Westside doesn't work. And I think what you'll see now, and I hope that this is true, is you're going to see a sport that kind of gets back to the roots of what it used to be, just because people are going to be forced this way. Like, who knows when gyms are going to open up. So everybody's training in garages and small groups.
Yes.
You know, the documentary came out, there's more information. It seems like there's kind of like almost this conjugate revival going around. So I don't know. I think the other end of this, it might get back to how the sport used to be, with a bigger community, like more of a community feel than it is, you know, people yelling at each other on the internet type of thing.
Yeah, there was no online coaches. There was no really even coaches 20 years ago. Kind of like the stronger guys would help out the you know, newer guys. And then usually with, it turned out if you were strong in a lift, you would kind of guide people with that lift. So a good bencher would kind of guide everyone with the bench program, a good squatter, same thing, and a good deadlifter. And everyone just kind of coached each other. It was more like training partners than it was some program or online thing. That's definitely a difference that I've noticed.
Yeah, and I hope it gets – I mean, that's how it should be, right? It should be everyone kind of helping out each other. That's how you push the sport forward. And, like, where I think people miss the mark is if you get stronger, it's going to push me to want to get stronger. So why wouldn't I want to help you? Because helping stronger is going to make me stronger. It goes back to, like, what you were saying before. Like, if you see people lifting more weight, you're going to lift more weight. So, I mean, I don't know. People miss that mark.
I believe Louis said right out, he goes, I don't write programs. You know, he goes, he gives you, I think Anthony Olivieri said, he goes, he just gives you enough rope to hang yourself. You know, he gives you enough information and, you know, go to work.
Yep. And I mean, it's kind of how I try to coach too. Obviously I have more beginner lifters, but sometimes I'll let them kind of sink a little bit and learn from their mistakes. I think it's an important aspect, learning a training skill. So we're coming up on an hour here, Mike. So I want to be respectful of your time and let you get back to your day and stuff. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. I think since we have such a young powerlifting community, people need to hear the people who've been around longer and you know, who've kind of learned from being in the trenches and doing it. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Oh, no, Kev, thanks for talking. I love talking training, and I wish there was more people to talk about it with this style. I mean, it's tough to find people that want to talk about the old ways of training or the Western style.
True. Or even just like what the old days were like in general. Like I love hearing those stories. Make sure you follow me on Instagram. It's KW Can, our team, Precision Powerlifting System. Stay strong, Boston.